Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You say you want to know where the economy is going? Well, how about this? You look in your trash can. I'm not kidding either. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 16th of August. And yes, there were some economic numbers out this morning. First-time claims for unemployment benefits, meh. And housing starts, too, also meh. But how about this? Trash, garbage, waste, refuse. Therein, my friends, lies the economic truth. It came to me in a chart I saw online the other day. Railroad carloads full of trash as correlated to gross domestic product. And the correlation is pretty close, too. Economist Michael McDonough has worked out the GDP to trash indicator. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for bringing me on to talk trash.
So, yeah, that's right. So explain to me how this works. I mean, because it's not like iron and steel, which are the biggest components of all this stuff, and demolition. It's not like that has anything to do with consumers buying more stuff and then throwing more stuff away.
That's what's great about this indicator. It's holistic because it's not isolated to a single part of the economy. It's people throwing things out. It's buildings being demolished. It's everything. The current levels are indicative that you may be seeing a weakness in new construction. I mean, if you're going to build a new building, there might be a building that's already there. If you buy a couch, you might be throwing out an old couch. If you go out to McDonald's and you buy something, you're going to throw something out. So the fact that it is as weak as it is right now means something's wrong in the economy, potentially, in the underlying economy.
Right. So what kind of trash are we talking here? Is this just everyday household waste?
You know, it's a whole mix of trash, actually. What you have is almost half of what the trash is iron and steel waste. And the next biggest component is your demolition and your municipal waste. Hmm. So places like New York City, Seattle, these guys are putting a lot of their trash onto trains, shipping it out to other states, and then dumping it there.
Yeah, and we should say that's where the data comes from, right? You get it from the American Association of Railroads or something, and those guys actually measure carfuls of stuff.
Exactly, on a weekly basis. That's what's even more interesting about it. When you think about the concept of using trash as a proxy for GDP, it's not a leading indicator. If anything, maybe it's a slightly lagging indicator because, you have to wait for people to throw things out, possibly. But more than likely, it's a coincident indicator. Except, for GDP, you need to wait a month or two after the quarter ends before you actually get that figure.
All right. Now, did this come to you in the middle of the night one night? Why are you tracking trash, man?
When I was in college, as a side project, I guess you'd call it, I studied a lot of anthropology and archaeology. And one of the way that you could track ancient people migrations was, and the size was, how much trash they left as they moved from point A to point B. So everything just kind of came together. I found the data, I ran the numbers, and it made a lot of sense in my mind.
Michael McDonough, he's a senior economist at Bloomberg Briefs. We got him in Hong Kong. The graph that we're talking about, you got to check it out. It's kind of crazy, the correlation. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
When you do check that chart, by the way, it's not going to be good news. Mike said there was something wrong in the underlying economy. About as bad as it's been since Lehman Brothers is what the trash tells us. Once again, the chart is on our website, marketplace.org. Okay, so as college kids go back to school, restaurants and shops around campus are getting a boost, but not all the money that they're spending comes from their summer jobs or their parents' pocketbooks, for that matter. Because in the world of college financial aid, the first couple of weeks of class are known as refund time. Marketplace's Eve Troe has that story.
Pierce College is a public two-year school in suburban Los Angeles. Anna Faye Robinson is financial aid director. Right now, students call her office every day asking one question.
Pretty much, when do I get my money? That's the phrase that we receive all the time. When do I get my money?
They mean their so-called refund from federal student aid. About half of Pierce's 15,000 full-time students get Pell Grants, and many also take government loans. The school takes its share for tuition, at Pierce less than $600 a semester. The rest goes directly to the student, often thousands of dollars. What's it for?
Room and board, books and supplies, transportation, and miscellaneous expenses.
Robinson says it's clear that money is to help with education, though students can spend it however they want. A new stereo, video games, clothes. Some then show up distraught, out of funds by semester's end. I may have been guilty of this myself. But the real problem isn't how students spend the money. It's that financial aid offers are confusing, says Lauren Asher at the Project on Student Debt.
It's not always clear in that letter what is a loan and what is a grant. Students might not see that they have a choice about whether to borrow some or all or none of that amount.
Asher says most financial aid students don't get enough help. They wind up working full-time or enrolling in college part-time to save money. Both up the chances that a student won't ever finish a degree. And that, she says, is the real waste. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
We went out to Facebook today and asked you what you spent your refund checks on. We got a whole lot of answers. Here's a couple of them.
Bills, food, apartment furnishings, and a weekend trip to New York, complete with a small shopping spree during my senior year.
Laptop, magic cards, a failed startup dorm room business.
Clothes that actually fit me decently. I was sick of wearing high school age things.
Cigarettes and booze.
My grandmother's 95 Toyota Avalon, a hefty dental bill, paid off a debt to the IRS, a summer traveling in France and Spain, and most recently, all the expenses to relocate and work in Ireland. Cheers, Sally Mae.
So there was that, and then there was the killjoy.
We need our youth to be more accountable, repentant of clueless, wasted spending and the like. Maybe I would like to say grow up and get out of that playing around mentality. But is that too harsh? They will learn. There's no free lunch.
Not too harsh. It's the smart thing, really. Tell us what you think or what you spent your refund check on, whatever you like. It's on Facebook or you can tweet us at Marketplace APM. Okay, this is the part of the show where for the past 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, I've been trying to come up with a different way to say, on Wall Street today, nothing happened. Well, on Wall Street today, quite a bit happened, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. China gets a whole lot of media coverage, as it should, being the world's second biggest economy and all. Just this week, there were headlines about Premier Wen Jiabao and how he figures they're going to hit their somewhat lower growth targets this year. But there's a problem with headlines like that, right? With big picture stories in general, you miss the heart of the thing. Our correspondent Rob Schmitz is in the middle of a year-long series about the Chinese economy, the people and the places that make it work. There are stories from a single street in Shanghai called the Street of Eternal Happiness. Today, Rob tells us about a man and his ink.
The Street of Eternal Happiness is mostly lined with dumpling stands, boutique fashion shops, street-side noodle vendors. This monotony is broken at number 434. A purple neon sign glows in a big picture window. It's advertising the Tsonglong Tattoo Studio. Inside, artist Tsonglong is etching ink from a buzzing gun onto the bare chest of a customer sunk into a barber's chair. Around them sit coworkers and friends with spiky hair, facial piercings, skimpy shirts revealing colorful tattoos. They chat and watch the artist at work, tapping their feet to a foreign song they don't understand, but that seems to understand them just fine. ...37-year-old Tsonglong considers it strange that he even owns this place. Growing up, he never thought China and its conservative culture would be ready for tattoo parlors. Years ago, Tsong etched his first tattoos into the bodies of his friends in the back of bars late at night. He used individual needles dipped in ink. Very unsanitary, he says. You couldn't even buy a tattoo machine back then.
说实话, 是应该是一些
At that time, people who had tattoos were mostly gang members. When I got my first tattoo, my parents were shocked. They were like, "Why did you do that? This goes against traditional Chinese beliefs." They got used to it. Part of my job is to change this negative stereotype of tattoos in China.
It's working. There are now hundreds of tattoo shops in Shanghai. China's most popular sports stars have tattoos. People like tennis star Li Na and badminton gold medalist Lin Dan. Still, the government frowns upon tattoos. Most public workers aren't allowed to have them. But Song says that isn't stopping them.
I'm getting more and more people from all walks of life coming in. I've even got kindergarten teachers. Teachers, doctors, police officers, they're all my customers. But they have to get tattoos where you can't notice them, or they'll get fired.
But even these rules seem to be changing. He says a few months ago, the Chinese military loosened restrictions on tattoos. He's already had an uptick in business from People's Liberation Army officers. And as tattoos become more common in China, Song says people want more individual styles.
When tattoos first became popular in China, I noticed a lot of Chinese customers wanted tattoos in English. Foreigners wanted tattoos in Chinese characters. Each culture thought the other was really mysterious. These days, people's tastes have changed. My local customers now want more creative tattoos.
An intricate tattoo of a blue tiger staring into the moonlight with ocean waves lapping around him adorns the shoulder of customer Chao Yue. That tattoo got Chao kicked out of China's Air Force years ago. Tang Long is engraving a new tattoo on Chao's other shoulder. This time, Chao's got nothing to worry about. He's his own boss. He sells private jets.
Think about the future, about my family, about my company. And
he asks me, without any hint of sarcasm, if I would like to buy one. Chao tells me he's spending $10,000 on his new tattoo. He's doing this to cover an old tattoo.
Before is my girlfriend's name, but now we are not together.
Chao had that tattoo for 5 years. His new tattoo is of a crane with its wings spread in front of a stormy sky. Crane is the name of Chao's new company in Chinese. This tattoo will last forever, he tells me, taking a draw on a cigarette, watching Song color in the crane's eyes. But you never know. China's changing so quickly. Chao may return to this tattoo parlor on the Street of Eternal Happiness sooner than he thinks. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's an interactive map, some videos, a slideshow of some of those tattoos, and more details from Rob's reporting online, marketplace.org. If you think of the world's top crime fighters getting together to tackle the biggest security problems we have, you picture what? Hushed meetings in the corridors of power? Maybe a dark hallway somewhere in Washington, D.C.? Yeah, how about a Marriott in downtown San Antonio, Texas that's swamped with out-of-towners? How about that? That'd be a good bet because that's where the International Association of Financial Crimes Investigators is meeting this week. We sent Andrew Oxford out to get in on the fun.
CIA headquarters, it's not. But it is a nice Marriott. My mission here is to find out what the leading minds in the world of financial crime do when they get together in one big room. Turns out, they talk a lot about technology. How to protect the billions of dollars that fly around the globe electronically every day. And it's not just gumshoes who are here.
We have banking, domestic, European banks, Australian banks, Canadian banks. Any type of retail.
James Gowron is the head of the group putting on this year's meeting. He says tech has changed the way everyone handles money, not just consumers.
You know, you have organized crime groups in different regions of the world. They all use similar techniques to generate cash.
Trying to stay ahead of the curve is Eric De Los Santos, a young deputy U.S. Marshal from Texas. He comes from a generation that isn't baffled by how to program their DVR, the kind of guys you need, not intimidated by technology.
Younger, new guys are coming in, new investigators. They're bringing with them, you know, what they've grown up with.
And with businesses rolling out new ways to take electronic payments every day, De Los Santos knows criminals won't be far behind. That's one of the reasons he's here at this conference, to keep one step ahead. In San Antonio, I'm Andrew Oxford for Marketplace.
Coming up...
Good God, we've got people breakdancing, we've got people talking on payphones, we stole candy from a baby.
No, man, don't do that. But hey, do have fun at work. First, though, we got to do the numbers. Some good corporate profits, economic reassurances from German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and boom, you got the happy music. The Dow Industrials expanded 2/3 of 1%, today 85 points, 13,250. Bell. The NASDAQ rose 1%, 31 points, 3,062 is the number. The S&P 500 grew 0.7%, 9 points, finished at 1,415. Financials were up. Bank of America posted a 0.75% rise today. Wells Fargo added 0.5%. Walmart's income and outlook were up, but not as much as analysts had expected, pushing its stock down 3%. Sears jumped 6% as it reported a narrower loss than expected. As we mentioned yesterday, today was the first day that early Facebook investors could sell off shares. The stock swooned 6%, new record low below $20. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. The University of Michigan issues its preliminary August survey of consumer attitudes and expectations about the economy. And too much of a good thing is wonderful. We have writer and stage and screen star Mae West to thank for that phrase and so many others. She was born on August 17, 1893. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. From APM, I'm Kai Rizdahl. I get, every now and then, a hankering for chocolate. And you browse the candy aisle closely enough, and you'll see it's gotten cheaper lately, in part because the price of the raw ingredient, cocoa, is off about 25% this past year. Good for those of us with a sweet tooth. Not so good, though, for cocoa growers. And that includes farmers in Colombia trying to get out of a different kind of business, cocaine. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
With U.S. help, Colombia's tried for decades to get farmers to grow, well, anything but the cocaine plant, like cocoa beans. Has it worked?
No. The producers, they're not satisfied with this substitution.
Aurelio Suarez Montoya heads a coalition of farmers in Colombia. I reached him in Bogota. He says with prices low, they lose money on cocoa, or cacao as he calls it, and they're tempted to return to the illicit plant for cocaine, coca.
Many farmers told me that if the cacao production is down, they could be returned to the coca production.
And the economics for illegal coca are good. There are 4 harvests a year. Demand is good. And it's way more convenient than cocoa beans, says Mark Schneider at the International Crisis Group.
It's a lot harder to carry a bulky quantity of cocoa to market versus the small amount that gives you equal profit of cocoa.
It's also hard to break into a sophisticated world cocoa market. This year, big producers in West Africa have flooded the market. And consumers, they're buying less of the end product, chocolate, says John Cox of Kepler Capital Markets in Zurich.
In a sort of recessionary environment, people are buying less chocolate bars. You know, potentially still buying chocolate, but it tends to be a bit more high-end, and so the volumes haven't been quite so good as usual.
By all accounts, Colombia's road away from cocaine will be long, and it may not involve other crops. One attempted solution? To get farmers factory jobs, making lingerie. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You know when you're out at a restaurant and at the table next to you a cell phone rings, or even worse, your dinner partner starts texting right in front of you? Annoying, even infuriating, right? Well, how about if the restaurant gave people a discount if they gave up their phones? Maybe, I don't know what, 5% off? You think that'd do it for you? Mark Gold owns Eva Restaurant out in West Hollywood here in Los Angeles, and he's given that discount a try. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
So why? How come?
You know, we want to give people a certain experience here at Eva, and we felt that the phone was a distraction.
But people like their phones, Mark.
You know, and people can still use their phones. I mean, for us, it was just, we just want to suggest it. For us, it's the art of, like, the lost conversation, how people don't converse anymore when they sit at the table what you see now is a cell phone on the dining room table. And, we're trying to get away from that.
Right. So tell me how it works. Does you walk in, you talk to the maitre d' or the hostess, and they say, here's your choice?
Well, we have it printed on the bottom of the menu.
Uh-huh.
And so when people are seated by the receptionist, they'll sit down and they'll see the menu, and it's stated on the bottom that, if you were voluntarily turning your cell phone, we would give you 5% off your bill tonight, as well as the server suggesting it when they approach the table.
Now, you have to physically give up the phone. You can't say, oh, yeah, I'll keep it in my pocket, because that would be
that's
my
That's cheating.
That's right.
No, we physically take the phone. We have a basket near the front desk, and we put their name on it, and we wrap it in a rubber band. And upon exiting the restaurant after the meal, we hand them their phones back.
Now, here's the thing. I mean, margins in restaurants are notoriously tight to begin with, right?
Correct.
And so if you get enough people taking you up on 5% off, it could conceivably hurt you a little bit.
Well, we might have to rethink this policy. But, for us, I wish I was a little bit more business savvy in a sense that, bringing more money to the bottom line. But for me, it's all about just giving the experience. And that's the main reason why I opened a restaurant. I just wanted to feed people and make them happy and have them experience what we're trying to do here at EVA.
How many people are taking you up on the offer? What portion of the house?
Right now, it's about 40%.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Now, does the restaurant get louder when people are actually talking?
What?
Does the restaurant get louder? Right? Yeah, very funny. Boom, boom. You got me. My dad used to do that to me.
It doesn't get, we're a very small restaurant. We have 42 seats. And, it's quite intimate. So it's not a loud restaurant by any means.
Well, now, would you say it's upscale?
Yes, it is upscale.
Okay, so here's my question. If you were a pizza place, would you be doing this?
Sure.
Oh, come on, really?
Yeah, because, it's not only about, it's about family as well. So, when we see people bring their kids in and they put an iPad in front of them, and they play games throughout the meal, that's just not connecting.
Now, here's the put up or shut up question. Do you do this too when you go out? You got your nose in your phone?
Unfortunately, I'm guilty. And I think that's part of the reason why I chose to do something like this is, I see myself with my children at the dinner table checking to see, who's called or the text message. And so I think, for me, it's about connecting with my family again and my kids. And we're very close. And I think I just want to do the same thing for everyone.
Other restaurants have tried this, right, and have had to back off.
I don't believe anyone has taken it to the level that we've taken it. I know there's been restaurants that have banned cell phones. And if you look on certain other menus around town, you'll see please refrain from using your cell phone during dinner service. But I think we've taken it a step further. We're actually rewarding the guests that answer their phone.
Yeah. You ever lost anybody's phone or had somebody take somebody else's phone?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Not yet, he says.
Not yet.
All right. Mark Gold at EVA Restaurant out in West Hollywood here in Los Angeles. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Happy hour.
Definitely ping pong tables.
Free lunch.
I'm guessing that the more money you make, the more fun your job is.
Truth is, not all jobs are fun, but there are some companies out there trying to make it so. Today's installment of our summer series on fun at work takes us to New York City, where Sally Herships reports that sometimes fun is best left to the professionals.
Here's an idea.
Work doesn't have to suck.
Ben Hoffman runs City Hunt, a scavenger hunt service for companies that want their employees to bond while having fun. You sound like, what's his name in The Office?
I don't know if I should take that as a compliment or an insult.
He's laughing because the character of the boss on The Office is the prototypical example of fun gone wrong.
Today, we are not just spending a day at the beach. We are all participating in mandatory fun activities. Funtivities!
Creating fun can be a delicate and tricky science, which is why Hoffman says you should bring in professionals like him. So to see fun as it is officially created, I tagged along on a scavenger hunt in New York with Global Strategy, a communications and research firm. The company was broken down into 7 teams and let loose in the city. Quick tip. It's helpful to be on the CEO's team. Wait a second, do you have a car here?
Yeah. Small advantage.
John Sullivan is CEO of Global Strategy. What have you accomplished so far?
Good God. We've got people breakdancing. We've got people talking on payphones. We stole candy from a baby.
How did that go over?
That went over fine. This is New York.
CEOs, not surprisingly, go-getters. which can be helpful when you're trying to score points for hunting a pair of twins near Union Square or a celebrity. I should clarify, this is a photo hunt, so instead of capturing an actual celebrity, the global strategy teams just had to take a picture of one. And even B-listers count. Who was the celebrity?
It was Kieran Culkin.
It wasn't really him.
Wait, like Macaulay Culkin's brother?
You got it. And he turned us down. I was like, come on, man. I was like, you're a great actor.
It was really hot out. But we worked together as a team. Well, the employees of Global Strategy did. They took their photo playing with five dogs at a time. And even serenaded a complete stranger.
Take me to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd.
That's good. That's enough. Woo! Thanks, buddy.
Sorry if what I'm about to say makes me sound like a party pooper, but is all this fun actually accomplishing anything? Alice Driscoll just started with Global Strategy 6 weeks ago, so I asked her to compare this company to her old one.
I mean, people are definitely happier. I feel like a little more excited to go to work.
Here?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a focus on happiness and not just making PowerPoint slides.
What employee doesn't want to get out of making PowerPoint slides? Still, is paying for a scavenger hunt worth it? City hunts cost between $60 and $160 per person.
And there are actually some pretty sound business reasons why having fun at work actually makes sense.
Rita McGrath teaches strategy at Columbia Business School. First, she says, the happier your employees, the better they'll treat your customers. Next, fun allows employees to be creative. McGrath says you can't plan flashes of insight. Sometimes you need to get your mind away from work. Think about companies that do creative work.
Their workplaces are really fun. They have colorful post-it notes and balloons, and people bring bikes to work, and you don't see them working in cubicles where everything's gray and it's all the same.
And added bonus, networking. It can be hard to keep corporate hierarchies in place when you and your boss are singing to strangers. It is possible one or two Global Strategy employees may have told me it was awkward to hang out with their boss, but most of the ones I saw seemed to be having fun. Even Michael the intern had a chance to prove himself. He managed to find a pair of twins.
You know what? I love this intern. I'm not going to have him pick up my dry cleaning anymore.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a hint of optimism about climate change. The Energy Department says the amount of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere in the U.S. the first part of this year was the lowest it's been in 20 years. Near as anyone can tell, it's because natural gas has gotten so much cheaper than coal. Of course, you can't get something for nothing. Gas is cheaper because there's so much hydraulic fracking going on out there, which is a whole different set of issues. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor around here is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.